All right, this is AP and Spence. We're two lawyers talking college sports and sports law in general. It's a stormy, kind of cloudy day here in Portland, Oregon. Been kind of raining off and on all day, June 3rd. You know, but how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I mean, we're into June in Los Angeles. This is called June gloom.
Right. Gets a little cloudy, but.
Yeah. I think in Oregon, it's just called June.
It's just a regular June.
It's just June 3rd. That's okay, though. Summer doesn't show up till July 5th, right?
That's
the day
right.
after the 4th of July
That's
in Oregon. Right. So we got about 31 days and we're going to get to summer. But yeah, it's heading into the weekend. And, you know, I'm trying to think, Spence, anything new going on with BYU?
Not really.
No.
I mean, you know, there's been some players coming in. In the transfer portal, players leaving the transfer portal. You know, baseball's done, softball's done. I mean, you know, there really isn't a lot going on. How about USC?
Just getting all the talent in the world. I mean,
yeah.
That's pretty much all they're doing is just getting every player known to man. This is going to be the largest transfer collection in the history of college football.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes, right? Because typically, like, you bring in the kids as freshmen. They, you know, some of them redshirt. If they're special, they'll play right away.
Yeah.
And then they get better, and you kind of get used to who these kids are. You're going to have, especially at USC, you're going to have the bulk of your players. You won't, will have all been transferred. I mean, they're supposed to have something like 30, 40 transfers, right?
Yeah, and they've started beefing up their line because everyone said they have a weak line. Now they went and got out a bunch of transfers for the offensive line, the defensive line, the defense. 60%, 70% of the players playing are going to be all transfers.
That's crazy.
And we've never seen it in the history of college football. It's going to be wild to see. Must-see TV. So the national TV, Fox or ABC, ESPN, has picked up every single game for the Trojans so far, except for Rice is going to be in the Pac-12 network the first game of the year. Because they're expecting it to be a circus. Like, they're coming to Corvallis. We should go to that game.
Let's go.
You know, and so...
Well, so, but I was curious. I mean, right now, probably your compliance office down in USC is going crazy with all these transfers, right?
Yes.
Getting waivers approved, bringing in all these kids, making sure they know the new rules, all that stuff. But in a typical year, it seems like there's not a lot going on around the June time, right? Is this kind of a dead period?
A little bit, yeah. So what I would do, it's summer, kind of the dog days, right? The athletes would leave. They'd go home. School would be over if finals are over. Some semesters don't end until, you know, end of May or something like that. Some quarters go to, like, middle of June. But they're kind of – so the quarter system's still kind of hot and heavy, but then they're going to leave. What we do is we do a lot of – camps. When I was at football, it's camp time, June
right.
and July. That was hot and heavy and wild because you have 10 camps off campus. Coaches are contacting. You want to go to this camp, all over the place. Can we do this? Can we get that approved? This approved. It's kind of a mess and pretty hot and heavy. We also do the coaches exam. The annual recruiting coaches exam is due by August 1. You have to get once a year licensed to recruit off campus. You have to pass this recruiting coaches exam. So we would usually administer it in June because if you fail, you got to wait 30 days. So you could try it in June. If you fail, you could try it in July.
Oh, that's great.
If you fail, you could do it the first part of August because you got to get in that road.
Is this an open book test?
Open book test, but you're really tight on your time. So if you're really digging through it, you're going to run out of time. So what we do is really educate the coaches. We'd make a little it's going to be almost all recruiting bylaw 13, a little bit of 14, make a little thing for the coach, educate them up. And then, boom, let's go. Let's take this. And most coaches could get 30 out of 30, 28 out of 30. But you had to get 24 out of 30 to pass.
Wow.
And we did have from time to time someone get 23. Sorry, coach, you can't recruit for a month. No big deal. You're still licensed, but I'm glad you took it in June because now you got to take it in July. If you pass, you miss that one, you're going to be held off the road for a little bit in August. We don't want that. So make sure you study and let's get it done. So you're doing coaches exam right now. You're doing camps. There's a lot of end of the year stuff that kind of gets wrapped up. International students, people start arriving on campus like in July.
Right.
For summer school, end of June. So it's almost a year-round thing in compliance. You're just working on different things. But all of a sudden it would be like, oh, all the international kids are coming. Hey, we have transfers coming in. Hey, we have kids that are coming. We got to get housing worked out. And so I always found that people say, oh, it's summer. You must be not doing nothing. It's like, well, no, I'm just doing different stuff.
Right.
But I'm still very busy. And then August was like just a circus, right? Like it was just everybody's here.
Yeah,
there's just
fall camps going.
Oh,
yeah.
Phones ringing, parents are coming. And so there was really rarely like a dead time in August. I would find that the only time, it depended on what sport you were working into, what
right.
their calendar was. But working with football, the time that was pretty good to take a little vacations is right after the year.
Right.
You know, kind of January, maybe like 4th to 10th. The problem is we had transfers coming in, eligibility issues. So there was really never a good time. I guess if any time I could take a little break, it was probably sometime the first part of August. We'd get all the kids – kind of right before they checked in, I'd get like 2 or 3 days right there, and then that was it. But another good time was Christmas. Christmas break, there was always 2 or 3 days off. And even if they're going to, unless they had a bowl game on the 25th or 26th.
Right.
So it was hard to kind of fit that in. And you know, the coaches would always go on their breaks, but it wasn't a good time for compliance because you had to get ready for other things. And then they would come back. And then, so it was a really tough, it's tough to get time off when you were in compliance, more than like a week or 10 days.
So the dog days of summers really applied to you then.
Yeah, oh yeah, they were heavy. But you know, I'd be wearing shorts and a polo and running around and busy as heck, you know.
Yeah.
And the tough thing about compliance is he was touching about being an intern at Houston, and or we'll get to a guest that's going to talk about some of that. You know, the hardest part I think about it was there's nobody really delegate to. You're the person. And so it's kind of like I can't delegate anything, right? There's maybe an assistant director in you, but like there's nobody else in the whole school that can do what you do. It's kind of like being an attorney in a sense, but if you had a huge organization that you're an attorney for, there's nobody you can really go to for help or get a question answered. You could maybe go to the Pac-12 or the NCAA. Otherwise, you're the only one who knows what's going on campus. And that was kind of hard. If you got kind of sick or something happened, things aren't running, you know? Yeah. And so that was a tough thing. Where if in marketing or other things, you could have other people that could figure something out.
Yeah. Well, a couple of weeks ago, just kind of shifting gears here a little bit, a couple of weeks ago, we had a really interesting discussion about NIL, right? This kind of the when the Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban's kind of feud happened, we kind of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole talking about kind of is the NIL system kind of breaking college sports? And then what? How would we fix it? Mm-hmm. And when we talked about that, we had a listener, a fan of the show, who's a lawyer down in Houston, actually, named Kennedy Jones, reach out to us and provide some really interesting insights on NIL. Kind of different way of thinking, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be a lot of fun to have him on. So why don't let's go to the phones. Let's chat with Mr. Jones here and talk with him. We'll hear a little bit about his story, his background, how he got into the law, and his thoughts on NIL. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones here.
All right, this is AP and Spence, two lawyers talking college sports, and we're going to the phones today, and we have a fellow lawyer who's joining us, Kennedy Jones, who is a business attorney, a tax aficionado, and a power broker, according to his Twitter page. But he made some really interesting comments to us about NIL, so we thought it'd be fun to have him on, and talk to him about that. But first and foremost, Kennedy, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. I just got off work a little early. I'm able to enjoy the sun a little bit, so I can't complain at all.
You know what?
Good weather down here in Houston.
Yeah, hey, you know, Kennedy, this is Aaron. You know what Spencer is? He's a weakness broker. But that's okay. That's okay. I digress. But well, first of all, Kennedy, thank you for. Do you go by Kennedy, or do you have a? Do you go by just K, or I want to make sure we're addressing you the right way.
Well, I'm a junior, man, so depending on who you're talking to, you might get a Kennedy, you might get a Ken, you might get a Kenny, so whatever you're comfortable with, I'm comfortable with.
What do your friends call you?
Ken.
All right, Ken.
Okay.
We're friends, right?
Yeah, we're friends.
Friends of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right, so Ken's here, and we've, for a little while, been wrestling with the whole idea of name, image, and likeness. You know, I worked in athletic compliance before all these came into play. I was at USC and Oregon State. I leave, and then they're like, you know what? Aaron's gone. Let's just let athletes do whatever they want to do. There's no reason to have any rules. And so athletes are, you know, they can use their name, image, or likeness to profit and that sort of thing. Oh, but you know what? Before we get into this, before I get into all the details of talking to you, because I was too excited, Ken, to talk to you, who the heck are you? Let's find out. You know, we know that you're an attorney. You're in Houston. The weather's good there.
And we know he's a power broker.
And he's a power broker. And I got too excited for my joke about Spencer's weakness broker that I just thought, give us a little of your background. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up? How'd you get into law? All that fun stuff.
Gotcha. So again, thank you guys for having me on. A huge fan of the show. Been following you since day one. A little bit about myself. I'm originally from Louisiana. I went to undergraduate school at Louisiana Tech. After I finished up there back in 2015, I started teaching for a few years, and while I was teaching, I was also an assistant football coach. So, you know, I played a little bit of ball while I was in high school myself, but I, due to injuries, I let it go. I didn't play while I was in college. So having an opportunity to teach and coach when I got out of undergrad, it really got me back involved in athletics. So fast forward 2 years after teaching, I ended up going to law school. And I went to law school at Texas Southern down here in Houston. I was there up until December of 2019. I finished a little bit early. And from there, I went on to the University of Houston, and I got my master's of law and taxation. But as far as, like I said, when I was teaching and coaching, that was, I would say, my initial entrance or re-entry back into athletics. So going into law school, I had the idea, of course. I think a lot of people who are familiar with athletics have the idea of, you know, becoming an agent after going to law school. But I actually had the opportunity, it was before my 2L year. Yeah, I had an opportunity to study abroad, and I went out to Oregon actually for a summer sports law institute over at the University of Oregon.
Yeah,
and while I was there, you know, they introduced us to you know, different realms of sports law. So of course, like I said, I had already been familiar with the idea of being an agent, but while I was there, that was the first time that I became really familiar with athletic compliance. So they had several people from Oregon State, from University of Oregon come over and speak to us. We had the opportunity to speak to some of the attorneys at Nike, some of the attorneys at Adidas. But that entire experience, being out there, like I said, having the opportunity to meet with so many people in compliance and learning that so many people that work in athletic compliance are lawyers, that was something that I didn't know prior to law school. So get back from that program at the end of that summer, and I reached out to a couple of different athletic programs here in Houston. And at the time, excuse me, University of Houston, they had some opportunities available in the athletic compliance office. So from the beginning of my 2L year up until I graduated from Texas Southern in December of 2019, I was working in the athletic compliance office at University of Houston. So while I was there, I got exposed to a lot of different things. And, you know, there had already been some rumblings about name, image, and likeness. Of course, you already had the, Bannon case, which was a few years before I got done with undergraduate and before I got to law school. You know, but I would say having an opportunity to work at U of H, that's when I really delved into it. So, you know, fast forward a year later, I actually wrote my my graduate research paper on intellectual property, specifically on NIL and athletics. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is an expert here is what we're doing, is we're bringing an expert on the show today. This is great.
Well, he wasn't messing around. He said power broker. And so we're bringing – as soon as I saw that, I said, we got to get this guy on this podcast. Hey, by the way, do you happen to know the name Lauren – I think it's Du Bois or Du Bois?
I do. I know Lauren very well.
Okay. Yeah. So I think my paths crossed with her a couple times in athletic compliance. And so, She was probably there when you were there, maybe, or
she was definitely there.
Yeah, okay, that's cool. That's not too bad. So we were kind of, thank you for that background. You have an amazing background. You've done some very successful, exciting things. Yes, a lot of people in athletic compliance are attorneys or at least attended law school. I felt like when I was at USC, there was like 11 of us in compliance, and like 9 of us went to law school. And then there was somebody that got like an MBA. And then there was a sports management online guy, you know, and which is fine too, you know, that's fine. The lawyers were, I would get grief. I remember like, you know, some people were like, oh, you're not a lawyer? Like, that's like a trade school. Like, if you're not going to be a lawyer, like, what are you doing? And it's like, well, but I'm still analyzing rules and for coaches, and I have to talk, and I have to write, and I have to analyze, and I have to think on my feet, and law school taught me a lot of that, so this isn't all wasted. But anyways, I digress. I'm bitter about that. But anyways,
to your point, I think a lot of law school does prepare you for working in athletic compliance. Like you mentioned, there's so much statutory interpretation when you're reading the code and you know, all those things.
Yeah,
so I definitely think that it helps to have a legal background when going into compliance, at least at that point, because there were so many intricacies and, you know, different little nuances, and you had to be able to weave through all of that. And I like you said, I know that law school helps and prepare you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm curious, Ken, about your paper there that you were talking about at the end about how the NIL paper. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit? Kind of what was your thesis and like what were you trying to prove in your paper?
Yeah, definitely. So the standpoint that I took in the paper, and again, I was at Texas Southern at the time, so I made it more focused on HBCUs. So essentially, I went into an analysis of, you know, the history of HBCU athletics when I felt like they were at their pinnacle, when you could say, you know, the likes of a Grambling State or Jackson State, when they were perennially putting people into the NFL, and you had Hall of Famers, you know,
sure,
Ed and Charles Jones, or you had, you know, Walter Payton at Jackson State, and doing an analysis about what changed, which, I mean, I think we all know when money got into it, and you know, TV money got into college athletics, a lot of that money started going to some of the larger schools, and with that, the larger schools were able to provide better opportunities. So a lot of those students that were going to historically black colleges were now going to different institutions. So the argument that I made is that with the entrance of NIL, you now have an opportunity for those students to not necessarily rely on the prestige of the institution so much, and now they're able to use their own name, their own image and likeness. And in the case of, you know, like a Jackson State, where you have a Deion Sanders, who also has that type of prominence, he's able to get attention for those kids, and they don't necessarily have to go to a larger school in order to be seen by the NFL, or in order to garner attention nationally, in order to get endorsement deals and things of that nature.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because a lot of times, you know, I went to BYU, so that's a smaller school, you know, not, and a lot of my concerns about NIL was that I felt like NIL was going to hurt the smaller schools, you know, because the smaller schools don't have the same level of endowments and you know, alumni that are going to be able to put the same amount of money in the kids' pockets for these NIL deals. But I appreciate your insight. I mean, your thoughts, like, you're exactly right, right? Like, you could, a school like a Jackson State or Grambling State could have a Deion Sanders type head coach and could bring kids in and then work with them to get NIL deals for these kids so that they could have the same opportunities to, you know, portray their talents and then get into the NFL, which ultimately is the goal. And it doesn't necessarily matter what school you're going to. So I like that. I like that a lot. That's really a cool thought.
Yeah, for sure.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know who won't like it is Nick Saban, right? That jerk. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And my thing with that is, and you definitely have a great point. But I guess my issue is coaches like Nick Saban throw out this idea. I call it a fallacy of balance. There's a balanced playing field, you know. And being frank, there is no balance. When you look at the last, I don't know, 20 national football championships, by and large, you see Alabama, you see a lot of Clemson, you see Ohio State, USC. By and large, it's the same 10 schools or so. And, I mean, that's the same across, I think, most sports. When you talk about basketball, when you talk about baseball, and that's not to say that you don't have a rare occasion where you have a Cinderella story, but I think it goes without saying that most years we know that Duke, Kentucky, you know, Kansas, they're going to make it to at least the Sweet 16. We know that without doubt. We know that Alabama, that probably Clemson, that Ohio State, that these caliber of schools are going to make it to the college football playoff. So being frank about it, I guess my thing is there is no competitive balance as we currently exist. So I think the smaller schools have to be content with saying, let's compete on our level, on our mid-major level, or whatever you want to call it. And the larger schools are going to compete on a larger level. I don't think that realistically, again, I went to undergraduate school at Louisiana Tech.
Yeah.
I'm a diehard Bulldog. Being frank, I don't think that we'll be, maybe not in my lifetime, maybe in my kid's lifetime, I don't think Louisiana Tech will ever be in a position to truly compete with LSU. And that's not to say that, that Tech can't get great, they can't get great student athletes, that they can't have great facilities, but it's just, it'll never be on that level. When you talk about a student enrollment, when you talk about the number of alumni, the number of alumni that have access to wealth, I mean, we've always been playing on an imbalanced field. I alluded to it in one of the messages, I believe. When I was out in Oregon, we had the opportunity to view the facility at UO, the football facility. And from my understanding, at least how the story was told to us, Phil Knight leased that, that plot of land from the university. I can't remember for how long, but essentially when that, that lease term was up, the new facility was there, and he just gifted it to the university. So I say that to say that those type of universities have always been playing at a different level. Oregon has always been looked at differently because of their access to Nike. USC has always been at the pinnacle, and I think that's going to stay the same. I don't think that NIL is going to exacerbate that. I think it's just going to be, like I alluded to, a redirection of resources.
Yeah, I mean, we're exactly right. And I love that point because I think it is a fallacy on Nick Saban's part where he's saying it's about competitive balance. There's no – that guy has no right to talk about competitive balance. That guy's in the playoffs every year, and he wants it that way.
Every
year. Yeah, yeah. This what it does is he doesn't want competitive balance, and this is sort of adding to some competitive balance. And so he's trying to get rid of it, right? And doesn't want it. He has a monopoly right now in the system, and the system's changing a little bit. So he's calling out people like Deion Sanders. He's calling out, coaches in his own conference, Texas A&M, because he's lashing out because he's realizing some talent has opportunities to go elsewhere now and still get some big deals and exposure. So I guess my first thought on digging into the details of name, image, and likeness. You know, some of the arguments, at least I've heard, against it are, it's being used for a recruiting tool, and people are just buying recruits, and that was never the intent of this. It was supposed to be just opportunities for kids, not manufacturing opportunities from boosters and things like that. And now the high school recruiting doesn't matter as much because the transfer portal is now kind of the way that everybody's going, and they're teams like USC are poaching receivers from Pitt, and it's all just kind of a money game, and it's hurt the sport because now it's about money and business, and there's no loyalty, with a team. People are bouncing around all over. Those are some of the arguments I had. There's plenty of others out there. And then I've heard some good stuff, obviously, too, right? There's senses of like, well, hey, it gives opportunities for kids to make money. They're the ones bringing the money into the school. Why can't they profit? If the coaches can leave, why can't they leave? They should have some flexibility to come and go as they want. So there's good and there's bad, and there's arguments all around. But it seemed like the consensus was at least a lot has changed, and things are different, and there's some mixed reviews out there, positive and negative. What are your personal thoughts on all of that, positive or negative? And then do you see any ways that it's working well, any ways that it could get better, anything like that?
I may be one of those guys that's completely, free enterprise. And I don't know if it's my background and having played, for a little while and having coached and whatnot. But in my opinion, let me start over. I was listening to a podcast, Conduct Detrimental. You guys are probably familiar with it. Dan Wallach and a couple more attorneys. They cover a lot of topics similar to what you guys do. And they had one of the attorneys on that was actually presenting an argument for the NCAA in the Austin case. And one of his biggest arguments was, why is it that everybody else affiliated, or at least most people affiliated with college athletics, are able to participate in a free market? If Nick Saban decides he wants to leave Alabama and go to USC, let's take Lincoln Riley. He decides he wants to leave OU and go to USC. That's completely fine. He's leaving a more rural area for a suburban area, a school that has probably more wealthy boosters. The weather is probably a little bit better. I say all that to say that everybody else affiliated with college athletics, for the most part, is able to take advantage of that system. If somebody else is willing to pay them more, they're able to hop on that opportunity. You know, while I was at U of H, we pretty much poached Dana Holgerson from West Virginia. And the whole thought process behind that, you know, though they never came out and said it, it was because they wanted U of H to move to the Big 12. And they felt like, you know, Dana Holgerson had that experience in the Big 12. So I say all that to say, why is it that when the kids are able to partake in that same industry, why does that diminish the sport? And I think that's my issue there. I get that some people say, hey, we don't want kids to decide where they're going to school based off of how much money they can get. And, you know, I have a few degrees, and I appreciate the value of education, but ultimately I think you get an education. So, I mean, you want to be an informed citizen, but you also want to be able to get a nice career and, you know, take care of yourself and your family if you have one. If these kids are in a position where they're able to do well for themselves, and people are willing to pay them, I have issue with us saying, no, we don't like that. And because we don't like that, you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, so that was one of the points he brought up when he reached out on Twitter. Because one of the thoughts that we had regarding the NIL is like putting a cap on schools, how much schools can have an NIL deals on a certain team. Similar to like an NFL salary cap, right? Or a Major League Baseball salary cap or something like that. You say, okay, this school can use a total of $10 million or whatever in NIL deals, and every school is capped at that number. Mm-hmm. But Ken, you brought up a good point in that there's no collective bargaining agreement for the kids, right? For the student athletes. And anyways, I mean, can you kind of expand on that a little bit? I really like that point.
Yeah, so what I was alluding to there, I mean, you do have your salary caps in most professional leagues outside of baseball. You know, that's wide open. And, you know, even in basketball, it's a little loose. They have a salary cap, but, you know, teams go into the luxury tax all the time for exceeding their salary cap. But the in general, most professional leagues, they do set limits on how much a particular team can spend on the players on their team. But the thing there is that you have players' unions in all of those professional leagues that meet, you know, with ownership, with management, and they have conversations, they have negotiations, and they reach the agreement together, you know, that this is what the cap will be, and or this is how we'll decide what the cap will be on an annual basis. What's happening here, or what's being suggested here, is that the NCAA or institutions or conferences, whomever, will get to unilaterally say, well, people want to pay you, but we're going to cap how much you can make. And you have no input on that. It's just going to be us dictating to you. And I think that's the big problem there. And, you know, for a while, I don't know if they changed it, but for a while, the NCAA was against players forming, though I don't want to call it a union, but what you want to call it, a trade organization or whatever. They were against the players forming an entity to collectively bargain. I think that, you know, again, that's one of my things. Okay, if we want to say that we can cap it, all right, that's fine. But at least let the people that it's affecting have input in. You know, don't dictate to them, oh, well, you can't do it because we say so, and we say you can't do it because we don't like you. I mean, I just, in no other field can I don't know of any other field that operates like that.
Yeah, because I feel like, honestly, at the core of all this, it's kind of funny. Other sports, other than basketball and football, have had a one-time transfer for a long time, where you could have soccer, other sports, and they've been dealing with that for a long time. And then now suddenly football's doing it, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, this is wrecking the sport. But I worked in football when texting wasn't allowed, and then they introduced texting. And everyone was like, this is going to wreck the sport, right? And so something's new, and football always seems to be last in line with some of that stuff. And so it's, I never buy that kind of the earth is, you know, the sky is falling argument, you know. And you know, it's, sports has changed, right? The days where it was like Yale, Princeton, Harvard, and these old-time programs from the 20s and 30s and 40s running around, and it was almost like club sport, you know, and people were just having fun going and watching the sport like it was high school or something, but it was just in college. It's a professional league now. I mean, there's like TV contracts. There's sponsors. I've been to the Pac-12 championship game. There's sponsors all over. There's media folks everywhere that's on national TV. USC's getting exposure. They run commercials during the championship game or the bowl game, so they're getting more applicants to the school. So everybody's boat is rising, but the boats that aren't rising are the players. They're just still getting the same scholarship that they got 30, 40 years ago before all of this changed. You know, Lincoln Riley's getting $22 million a year. That the coaches' salaries used to be 2, 3, and 4 million. Now they're like teens and 20s, you know, and they've been, you know, not wanting to give the power to the athletes to be able to unionize or sort of have collective bargaining or kind of run their own ship in the fear of like they're going to get more power. They're going to want more say. They're going to want more health protections. They're going to want more days off. They're going to want more, right? And but that's the same argument that like some major corporations that have employees and they try to not want them to unionize and because they don't want them to get more pay and better benefits. But our whole system, when the people that are used as the talent rise up and get things changed for themselves, it usually does take from the power structure a little bit, but it makes things better. And I don't, and there's always that sky is falling argument. This is going to wreck the sport. This is going to this and that. And a lot of that's just unfair rhetoric that I don't think will actually come into play. Because you still have to be 3 years removed from high school to go to the NFL, so you're still going to play in college. In fact, I would almost argue people might even stay longer in college because they don't have to jump at whatever deal, you know. And they think, you know what, I'm going to be a third-round pick, fourth-round pick. I'm going to stay in college, get at my $2 million a year doing this NIL deal. Maybe I'll go in the next year. I'm going to stay for my senior year, you know, and people have – they're going to have less agents, maybe like enticing families to do inappropriate things because they're going to put 20 grand in their pocket, you know? And so there's a lot of good that can happen from this, I think, too. Right?
Absolutely. I also think one of the things that a lot of people are overlooking, I was watching ABC Sports, maybe, you know, a week and a half ago, and they were doing a little report on NIL. And, of course, you know, football and basketball were, you know, the top two sports that had the most players getting NIL deals. But the next three sports in line were all women's sports. I can't remember. I think it was women's basketball, might have been softball and tennis or something like that. But I say that to say so much emphasis was placed on, only be football players and basketball players, men's football and men's basketball that'll receive these deals. And that just simply isn't the case.
Yeah, that's right. It's easy to kind of point to a Caleb Williams at USC and say he's got a Beats by Dre deal for $2.1 million. There's a handful of guys like that, but there's plenty of other deals where people are making $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 or whatever and have a deal. And it's an opportunity for them to make a little money, buy themselves a car, help pay for school, whatever. It's just more opportunities, and you can spin it positive or negative depending what your angle is, you know. But in the end, it's hard to argue against more opportunities for people to make money. Why is that necessarily a bad thing? And it's hard to really point to really valid reasons other than nostalgia and, oh, it's the way it used to be and those kind of things, which are all great, but it's easy for the person that already has a job and they're 55 and they have a house and they got a nice salary and to say that to 18 and 19 year olds that maybe have no money and maybe their family, they don't come from any money and they could really use those couple of years to make a little money because their earning window might be small if they're basing it on sport, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and even in the instance where you have people that may be financially stable or you know, might not be strapped for cash, in terms of some people's highest earning capacity, a lot of these athletes is in college. You know, most college athletes don't go professional. Very, very, very few of them do. So when I think about, let's say Vince Young, right? If he had been able to capitalize while he was at the University of Texas, and when I think about a Maurice Claret, who never really had the opportunity to play in the NFL, but had he had the opportunity to capitalize while he was at Ohio State, his life might be completely different now. So, yeah. You know, those type of situations are what makes me say, why not? You know, I have issue. Why not?
Hey, Ken, I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball at you, because I'm just curious. Okay. And because you're a tax aficionado, how do these NIL deals affect these kids from a tax perspective, right? Because the scholarships and the room and board that they were getting were not taxed, right? That was just money that was given to them. But now with these NIL deals, I assume that these guys are going to be getting, you know, like I would think 1099s or some type of award. They've got to be taxed, right? I mean, they're not just given free money that's untaxable. So how does the tax code apply to these kids? I know this is probably a totally loaded question, but from a general perspective, like if you're advising a kid who's getting a deal for $100,000 to play at, you know, Texas Southern or whatever, what's your advice to them from a tax perspective?
It's going to be treated like ordinary income. So in that regard, you have to pay taxes on it, you know, just like anybody else would have to pay taxes on their income. So the advice that I would give a kid in that situation is, I think a good rule of thumb is to put aside 35% for taxes. If you're talking about a 1099 situation, and if it's a 1099, if they're an independent contractor, whomever it is that they have that agreement with, they're not going to be taking taxes out of that. They're going to just report that income, report that payment to the IRS at the end of the year, and then it's going to be on that student athlete. It's going to be their responsibility to pay the taxes on that income. So if you're in a situation like that, you know, where you're getting that a large lump sum like that, I would definitely say that to be on the safer side, to put aside 30-35%, and then, you know, when tax time rolls around at the beginning of the next year, when you do your filing, you already have that money set to the side, as opposed to saying, oh man, I owe the IRS X amount of dollars because I didn't pay taxes from this NIL deal.
I just was curious. That's perfect advice, and I appreciate it. I just was curious because I don't, you know, that's kind of one of those issues that arise, legal issues that arise, that I think a lot of people aren't thinking about. Like you know, you're the Williams guy at USC getting $2.1 million from Beats by Dre. It's like, okay, that's awesome, but he still has to pay taxes on that, right? That's not considered the same as scholarships, or considered the same as the money that was being paid under the table,
right?
Like before all this NIL stuff changed, right? Like kids were getting paid 200, 300 grand to come play at a school, you know, but it was all cash and it was all under the table. So, you know, but now it's like, now I actually feel like, you know, that the NIL are kind of providing some guidelines, right? Like some barriers or some guidelines or some restrictions on, hey, okay, so you can, here, you go out and make money. You go get this NIL deal. We want you to play here. That's great. And now you get to go pay taxes on this too. So it's all above board now, right?
And to
your point, I think this system is better, because if we would be lying to ourselves to think that this wasn't taking place before July 1 of last year. Kids were absolutely getting money from boosters in some way, shape, form, or fashion. I think now what we have is, in most cases, a true exchange for value, where these kids are providing some type of service, whether it might be simply showing up to an event or saying, hey, I bought my car from XYZ dealership or whatever, as opposed to them just showing up at school and booster throwing them a chunk of money. So there's that regard. And then, like you said, from a fiscal standpoint, you know, on the state level and on the IRS level, there are a lot of donors who are willing to pay a lot of money. And it's been going on, like I said. So now those dollars are being taxed, and that money can be poured back into the community. It can be poured back into the university, you know, those type of things. So I think, you know, the more that we discuss it, I feel like there are more pros than cons. And, you know, that's not to say that there aren't bad actors, that people won't abuse the system. But again, I guess my biggest thing is, if we can say, hey, Nick Saban or hey, Lincoln Riley, we'll give you $15 million to come to USC, and we'll buy out your $2 million clause at the University of Oklahoma. If that's okay, then why is it bad for the kids? You know? And that's where I am.
Yeah, I mean, business is business, you know what I mean? And it is what it is. If you have an elite skill that other people don't have, why can't you capitalize on it? I mean, it's no different than maybe an actor. I mean, I was down, spent a lot of time in L.A. You'd have actors in the film school at USC, and they'd be going to school at USC and then auditioning for shows. And I knew several people that got on, like Boston Legal, and they got on shows, and they were making large checks having speaking parts while going to school because they were using their talent as an actor that they had a good ability and a good look about them or whatever that was different than everybody else. And so they have a better skill that they could capitalize on. So why is athletics any different than everybody else, you know, that can't capitalize on that skill at that time?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And, you know, it might be a cynical look on my part, but I think that the way that the college athletic system was set up, again, if you have donors for days who are willing to donate to their alma mater ad nauseum, you know, but these restrictions forced that money, again, it was a redirection, that these restrictions forced that money to the institution. It forced it on the, you had to spend it on facilities. You had to spend it on coaches, on support staff. You had on all those things. And I think, frankly, that a lot of people do not like the idea of losing that money to the kids. And that, again, I think that it might be very cynical, but I can't think of any other way to rationalize it.
That, you hit the nail on the head. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because what's going to happen is, right, you have the department that does like fundraising, you know, and all of that for the school, you know, and you got donor, you have relationships with all these various donors. I remember that happening at USC all the time. It was development. It was called apartment called development, right? And really what it was about is getting money in the door from big time boosters to pay for projects. Well, now when you go to, you know, hey, booster, $1 million booster, gosh, we'd really love you to help facilitate this new tennis court that we need. That booster's going to say, yeah, but I'd like to put some money in the kids' pockets. Do you have any football players I can set up a business for, right? So they're now competing for the money. So you might see some of these schools not setting up all these lavish $100 million buildings and paying all the coaches because maybe some of that money now is getting tied up to go to the kids, to the talent. And that's funny. I hadn't even really thought about that perspective. That's probably exactly right. So development, administration, some of these schools don't like it for that perspective because it's more people competing for that money, those rich boosters that they need. And that's funny. It's funny how it works. You know, money makes the world go round. And it's funny how a lot of this comes down to that and a piece of the pie and things like that. You know, I mean, Spence, what do you think? I mean, are any rules or guardrails needed? I keep hearing Nick Saban say guardrails are needed and we need to protect the program. Is there anything reasonable we could set up without hurting the kids and the money?
That's the tricky thing, right? Because you don't want to put any cap on what the kids can make and you don't want to put any restrictions on, you know, there already are some restrictions, right? Yeah. It can't be pay for play. It can't be, you know, you can't do something that's against what your school, if you're a Nike school, you can't sign in a deal with Adidas, et cetera, et cetera. So there are already some restrictions, right?
I even have a little bit of pushback with that, though. I mean, you know, not to date you guys, but I'm sure you guys remember the whole situation at the Olympics with Michael Jordan, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I guess that's my thing. If you're saying, hey, we're a Nike school, because we're a Nike school, you can't sign a deal with Adidas, to an extent, I just feel like that's too restrictive. I understand that if we're in an official capacity, if I'm on the field, if this is a team event, I need to be in whatever apparel company sponsors the team. But if we're talking about if they want to give me my own signature shoe or, you know, a t-shirt line or something along those parameters, I don't understand that rationalization. I think, it's one way to restrict those students, and I just, for so long we've been doing it, and I haven't heard good rationalization as to why, other than, like you said earlier, it's going to ruin athletics, the sky is going to fall. What I will say, again, having coached, having played a little bit of ball myself, I had the opportunity to, like I said, intern at the University of Houston, and for a while I actually worked in athletic compliance at Grambling. And a lot of student athletes would say that they feel like the model is already broken. So, you know, when people throw around, oh, if you do this, it's going to ruin the model. For a lot of the kids that are participating in this model, for the vast majority of people that are devoting their time and energy to this model, they feel like it's already broken. And what we're doing is now correcting it. You know, not to go too deep down the rabbit hole, but when O'Bannon happened back in, I think, 2012, EA Sports said they were willing to essentially pay the universities or pay the teams for the name, image, and likeness. The NCAA said no, they didn't want that. So I think, and this is just me, I think if you had an NCAA leadership that was willing to work with players back then, I don't know if we get to this point now. But yeah. Because they've been so hesitant and they've been so eager to place restrictions, that's where we are now. There's actually a case, I'm sure you guys are probably familiar with, I think it's Jefferson versus NCAA. It's in the Third Circuit of Appeals right now. We already had a federal judge that ruled in favor of the plaintiff, saying that college athletes should be declared employees of mm-hmm. universities. Then you add, in addition to that, I think her name is Jennifer Abruzzo. She's the general counsel for the NLRB. She's saying that she feels as though student athletes should be labeled employees. And she went a step further to say that she felt like the term student athlete was created to, I guess, try to separate the idea of student athletes or these athletes being employees of the university. So, again, if it hadn't been so much resistance, I don't think you would be getting this much fight.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because I know it is a job, right? When you're a student athlete, I know that's a term that's still used. But I had a brother who swam at BYU, and he was not on a scholarship, but he was swimming, you know, a lot and working out a ton. I mean, it was like a job, right? And he was swimming so much he couldn't hold down a regular job because he was swimming, you know, swimming for the university, right? I mean, so it is a job. It just, you know, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. That's a really interesting case, and we've talked about that case a little bit, but it's an interesting theory, you know, or it's an interesting idea to name these student athletes as employees of the university rather than student athletes.
Yeah, and to back that up, I got an interesting quick story to that point. Like when I worked for football at USC, the kids were not allowed to have outside jobs during certain parts. They would get in trouble by the coach. Like it was like, no, you can't have a job. Your job is football. And I remember traveling with the team. I would travel to all the games. And at the time I was about, I don't know, I was like 36 years old. Older guy, older than them, but still a relatively young guy. And we would work. We would go to like Washington State, right? And so we would get into town on like Friday, you know, we'd travel to Washington State, fly there and bus over and practice and eat. We'd get done with our game at like 10 at night on Saturday, some late night game, or 10:30 at night, get over to the airport. We would leave Pullman, Washington or in Idaho somewhere at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And we would get back to Los Angeles at like 4 in the morning. We'd land on this private side. We'd bus over. We were getting back to USC like 4:35 in the morning on Sunday. Now, I'm exhausted, right? I'd get back to my house in Los Angeles at like, I don't know, 6 or 7 in the morning. And I would like crash until like noon and then just be like a dog the whole day on Sunday. I couldn't get anything done. And I'm back to work on Monday still tired. These kids would be back on Sunday doing some like kind of workouts on campus, studying, that sort of thing, and then back to class on Monday. And I thought, man, how are these guys doing all of that? They can't work. School and football is like all they can do. They're super busy, and then they can't capitalize on it. It's so funny. And I remember having a star athlete. I won't say his name, but he came, and when he was brand new, he was a freshman, he came to me, and I handed out stipend checks. And they would get stipend checks, and I used it as an opportunity to do some rules education. So when they had to get a stipend check from me, I had to give them a reminder. And I would give them a reminder, and I told this kid, I gave him a check, and he goes, it was his first check, he's a freshman, and he goes, I didn't know what he meant at the time, but he looks at it and he goes, 9 stacks? And I said, nine, what's that? You know, and he said, nine stacks. And I said, nine stacks. I hadn't heard the term before. And he goes, yeah, it's like $914. And I said, oh, yep, stack is 100. Okay, yep, that's right, man. $914 is yours. He was like, this is like the best day of my life. He goes, I can't believe I'm getting this much money to play football. And this was one of our stars. This was a guy that was starting as a freshman. He's in the NFL right now. And to him, it was like world changing, you know, and so it was kind of funny of all the things he had to do. Nine stacks was like, and at the same time, you got people, you know, that are getting $4 million a year. You got athletic directors that are getting two. There's people in compliance making six figures. So it was just kind of funny that, you know, the talent was getting the least amount of money and very excited. And so I could see it from that perspective. And if you look at it from that area, it's tough to argue against.
I think it's been a long coming thing. I think it's been a foregone conclusion. I'm happy that we're here now. I think I'm interested to see how some of these other things play out. The California Act, where they're essentially trying to do some revenue sharing. I think that'll be pretty interesting to see how that pans out. My thing is, I just want to see these student athletes, these athletes, kids, whatever we choose to call them. I want to see them be able to capitalize. Like you said earlier, anybody else that has the ability to trade on, or most people that have the ability to trade on their name, image, and likeness, they don't have a restriction in that regard. If this is, let's say, somebody that's in the band, there is no restriction from the band department saying, hey, you can't go play live jazz on the weekend to make a little bit of money, you know, or maybe this is what you like to do and that's what you want to do. And you happen to make some money in the process. You have to happen to get a few coins. There's no restriction on that. Like you, same thing you can say with the choir, with acting. It's only with athletics. And I think, again, it's so much money that flows through athletics. And it's been such a push to try to keep that money in the same hands. And I think now that it's moving in different directions, so many of people are saying, oh, the sky is falling. And it's not that the sky is falling. It's just that things are different, and they don't like different.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Ken.
With all the complaining, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
With all the complaining that Nick Saban did and, you know, saying that Jimbo bought that whole team or whatever, you still had the number two recruiting class in the nation.
I know.
In my recollection, since he's been there, he's had a top three recruiting class perennially. So, again, you throw out, oh, competitive balance. This is destroying competitive balance. I don't understand how a team in your league getting a better recruiting class than you while you still have the number two and now possibly putting the same caliber of athletes on the field as you.
Yeah.
I don't understand how this ruins anything.
Not at all. It just, you know, he maybe doesn't win as much, right? Yeah. All of a sudden he's not going to the playoffs and he doesn't look like a genius coach. Maybe he's just been riding the coattails of some elite players for a long time. And now those players are going a few other spots and he's worried about it. And, you know, which I like to see. You know, I want Nick Saban sweating it. You know, change it up a little bit, man.
Let's go.
Let's get.
I'm an SEC guy, man. But, you know, I like the idea of a USC being competitive again. We hadn't had a USC championship since, Reggie Bush back in 05?
Exactly.
Almost 20 years ago now.
Yeah, back when Vince Young cheated. I remember that. Yeah.
You should have seen Aaron's face when you brought up Vince Young. He hates that guy.
Oh, man. Yeah. So since then, but you're right. But I think Lincoln Riley, he's gathering some big talent. I would love to see... in fact, one organization out there has Alabama versus USC in the playoffs this year. I would love that if that happened. We'll see. SEC still has all the power, and they have most of the talent in that area and the best facilities and fans. So it's going to be really hard for the Pac-12. I guess as a parting thought, I know we got to let you go. It's a busy Friday. What do you think? This is a way off-topic subject, but just what do you think the Pac-12 football needs to do to try to catch up a little bit to the SEC, or is there anything they can do?
What does the Pac-12 need to do? That's a good question.
It's just too many things.
I think it's a multi-layered thing. I have some friends out there on the West Coast, and not to say that you guys don't care about football as much on the West Coast, but, football is king down here in the South.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, the marketing aspect and how you build up the football program, it has to be a lot more investment in that regard. I think that, you know, getting a coach like Lincoln Riley, you're doing good, but I think you have to have a few more coaches that have some name recognition. I know you guys had Herm Edwards over there at Arizona State for a while, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, there's no knock against Herm, but I think if you have, frankly, some younger coaches, some guys that are, you know, doing some moving and shaking in the college ranks, I think that can help build it up. But frankly, I'm an SEC guy. I think they got to play better defense, man.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
it's fun to see people score, but I mean, at least for a fight, I don't want to just watch the barn burning, and I think that's part of the thing.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Pac-12 schools do not play defense. They have weak offensive and defensive lines historically. It's kind of the spread offense that Chip Kelly kind of brought over and tainted the offense. And Pac-12's fallen way behind, and I think they're trying to find out ways to beef it up. But we need some better coaching. We need some better athletes out here, some better facilities, and let's see what they do. And also, I'll throw it out there, they need a little more diversity in their football coaching as well. Speaking of HBSU, different, you know, I was thinking about this. I heard a thing when I was talking to Lane Kiffin one time. I don't know, he probably won't care if I say this, but I was talking to him and he was saying that, like, you know, it's like a good old boys network, right? Where kids grow up with other coaches, they get pulled through the ranks, they become GAs, they become coaches, and it's the same families, it's the same groups that keep getting all those jobs. And, you know, and it's the power brokers, right? And there's a little power dynamic there. There's a power dynamic with money of the athletes and schools. There's a lot of little power dynamics that need to be broken up because I think that's just good for society in general. I'll end it on that subject.
Yeah.
I agree with you completely there. And I think anytime that you can inject some diversity and, you know, you can add some different perspectives, you're able to, I think, relate to a broader audience. And I think that definitely helps with whatever product you're trying to put out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, Ken, thank you so much for jumping on today. We really appreciate you. We'd love to have you back on the program maybe in the future sometime, maybe when Alabama and USC are playing in the national championship this year.
Hey, man, just shoot me a message. We can make it happen.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. Have a great day.
See ya.
Thank you for having me, guys. You take it easy.
All right. Well, that was an awesome conversation with Ken. I was honestly, he changed the way I was thinking about NIL. I mean, honestly, like, I was a little bit more of a harsher, you know, there needs to be some rules. There needs to be some guidelines, some barriers. Mm-hmm. But he brought up some really good points. And actually, it got me thinking about why put any barriers on these kids? There aren't barriers on, like you brought up with the USC actors. There's no barriers on them. They could sign a deal to go do a movie with Tom Cruise. They could do Top Gun, you know, Maverick's Return or something.
Yeah.
And do it $2 million and still be a student. Right. Yeah. So there's no cap on that. So why should we put any cap on student athletes?
Yeah, Ken Jones. Ken, because he's a friend of the show.
That's right.
And a fan. So he's our friend. He said his friends call him Ken. I'm gonna call him Ken.
That's right.
Ken Jones, attorney in Texas, lives in Houston. They have obviously better weather than we have right now, I'm sure. But yeah, you know, look, I mean, there's always arguments on all the sides, right? Because you could say for the actors, well, gosh, they have to be a member of SAG. And they got to pay their dues, and they can't, sure. You know, or hey, attorneys, yeah, you could negotiate a settlement, but until you're licensed attorney, you can't. You know, there's always parameters on things, but I think this is at least a step in the direction of, like, I did think it was a little weird when I was at USC, and I was kind of like, gosh, this player's catching balls on Saturday, well known over the whole campus. There's a billboard on the freeway of him. There's his number jersey, not his last name, but just his number, is hanging all over the bookstore, and they're selling it $150 a pop. You know, he's giving shout outs for marketing and ticket sales because the NCAA scoped that out, that you can use these players to promote your own internal marketing and ticket sales.
But the kids can't make any money off
that. Yeah, so I thought this is kind of weird that they allow that. And you get nine stacks or whatever they call it. You know, and so, yeah, I get it. They got to – but I think the guardrails are more probably about the abuse of it.
Right.
The recruiting angle, because it's becoming kind of this like race to the bottom and let's figure out what boosters we can line up to buy these kids to come to our school. And – that's really nefarious, and yeah, maybe that can help the kids, but it's kind of becomes whoever has the biggest boosters, the most resources, eventually are going to win and get all the talent.
Right.
And,
but you can't, you can only have, you know, one or two or three or four elite running backs. You know, you're not going to be able to pay, you know, the top 12 running backs to all go to USC.
Yeah.
They're not all going to do it because they want to go to a school where they're going to get recognized and play.
Yeah.
Right. So if the top 12 running backs in college, you know, that are high school athletes are all getting $1 million deals, you know, I guess in theory USC could say, hey, we've got 12 boosters all giving you guys $1 million each. You come here, we're all good to go. I don't think all 12 of those kids would do that. Right. So some of those kids would be like, wait a second, if 1 through 4 is all going to USC, you know, I'm the number 5 guy, but I'm also being recruited by. Where, you know, by UCLA, I want to go play. I'm going to go play because I'll play.
Yeah, I'll be a starter there.
These kids are competitive. They want to get out and they want to play.
Yeah.
It's not just about making the money. They want to get out. They want to showcase their talents. Hopefully get to the NFL, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Anyways, it's kind of an interesting discussion. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. They're good angles, good thought. I'm glad we have a fan of the show. You know, the few, the proud of this show, right? You know, Spence. And we from time to time have some people say they like our show and we have some fun and we bring good knowledge. I mean, that's the end. We're trying to just talk about these topics, talk about all the angles, all the areas, what can be done. Tax implications. You heard him say it's if you're getting these deals, it's going to be treated like income. You're going to have to pay taxes, at least set aside 35%. If you don't pay your taxes, Spence, bad things happen,
right? That's right.
Like, it's not good.
It's not good.
So I'm no tax attorney, but I will be able to advise pay your taxes.
Yeah, that's good.
Right?
Yeah, listen to AP there. Yeah. And to Ken.
Pay your taxes. Find a professional. Get some help. Anyway, so yeah, good stuff. Name, image, likeness has a lot of nuances, a lot of angles, a lot of kind of layers to that onion, all the different arguments. Development offices might not like it. Kids like it. Agents may not like it because you used to be able to persuade kids to come to you because you could give them extra benefits under the table. Right. Now you're not going to have that Santa Monica agent, that small-time up-and-coming agent say, hey, I could put 10 grand in your mom's pocket. Why don't you sign with me? Because now if that kid's already getting $2 million a year, what are you going to offer him? He's like, you know, you're not going to give him $20 million.
That was the whole Zion Williamson case, right? Yep. So anyways.
You know what you're going to offer Zion Williamson? Cheeseburgers. Have you heard that guy? That guy, they might not get a max. He may not get a max contract because he's overweight. He's only played like 84 games in his career. And he's starting to turn into a little bit of a Greg Oden.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so that's not good, Spence. And then last comment, Spence, what do you think about Phil Knight buying the Trailblazers?
Oh, yeah. I first of all, I would be 100% in favor of Phil Knight buying the Trailblazers, and I hope it happens.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because Phil Knight is a competitive – what he has done for Oregon State, and Stanford is unreal. Imagine if he did that with the Blazers. Put that same – money and attention and
uniforms
and I mean the Blazers could be a cool place for people to go.
Yeah.
I mean how many recruits are going to Oregon, you know, in the recent years because they want to play at a university where they get to wear these awesome sweet uniforms.
Yeah.
Every uniform is different. They're playing on ESPN, they're flashy,
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if he brought that same kind of ingenuity and thought to the Blazers. How fun would that be?
Yeah, they're wearing different uniforms and they have cool things. And Oregon, they have better facilities and really make it a place to get somebody to play with Lillard. You start making the second, third round of the playoffs, get some excitement and buzz. I feel like the Blazers right now are kind of a no fun zone.
Yeah, I mean, so like, you know, Paul Allen, I honestly believe Paul Allen was was a great owner.
Yeah.
He seemed to be really engaged.
He wanted to win.
He wanted to win.
Spend some money.
He did the same up in Seattle. He did mm-hmm. the same here.
Yeah.
Right? He seemed like he, but, you know, unfortunately he passed away. And then it went to his trust, and I guess his, like, sister is running it now.
Jody Allen.
Yeah, she just doesn't strike me as someone. I'm sure she's a great person, but she doesn't strike me as someone who is like Paul Allen or like a Phil Knight would be, who just loves the sport and wants to see the Blazers succeed.
Yeah.
It seems like it's just kind of another entity to her.
Yep.
Right? Which is fine. You know, she's a business person, right? And she's going to make a business decision. But at the end of the day, I would love Phil Knight to own the Blazers. I think it would be spectacular.
Oh, yeah. I hope it happens. I know they said it's not for sale, but I think it's going to be for sale. It's just not technically for sale right now. I think they're going to keep trying it. I'll bet you he ends up buying. He's probably going to have to spend like $2.5 billion. He's going to buy those Blazers and then just dump tons of money in it and go get like two or three free agents, have some cool gear, and get the Blazers back going again, man. Get the Northwest basketball going.
For me, it is the Cougars, right, number one. Anything BYU related. And then number two is the Blazers. I mean, I grew up loving the Blazers. It is so fun. And it was not fun to be a fan of the Blazers last year.
No, it just wasn't.
I can't remember a season where they tanked that poorly. Even in the Jailblazer years,
yeah.
They were still playing hard.
Yeah, that was a joke.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, so it was crazy. And you would get a ticket for a game for $6. Go see a game. And even then, no one was going to the games.
No.
And so, obviously, something is broken at the Blazers. And I think injecting the Phil Knight sauce into the Blazers would be awesome.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, hopefully it happens. So we're going to see and build around Lillard. And I think that sale's coming. Because, you know, the worst-case scenario, Spence, is he gets sold to somebody and they move it to Vegas.
Yeah.
Ugh. The Vegas Blazers. Are you rooting for them?
No way. I'd be done. I would just be a fan of the NBA. Just like I'm a fan of the NFL right now.
Yeah. Your fandom's not following.
I'll cheer for the Seahawks because they're local-ish, you know. But yeah. I just kind of cheer for whoever. If it's a good game, it's a good game. I'll watch it.
Yeah.
You know? But that's what the NBA would turn into for me. If the Blazers left.
If they left, and especially if they're in Vegas or something, Vegas Blazers, forget it, you know. It better stay Portland. So we'll find out. Well, that was a good podcast, Spence. I think we got a new fan. Hopefully he keeps listening.
Yeah, I think so. You know? I think he's a big time fan.
That gets our fan. Awesome. That gets our listeners up to four
at least. Yeah,
nationally. No,
my dad, your dad,
my wife, your wife, and now him five.
That's five. That's
you know, sure. So no, we're good. Hey, we got listeners verified in 50 states, right, Spence?
And 40 countries.
And 40 countries. So let's go. Let's keep it going.
All right.
All right. See you, everybody.